refuse. We will ask the Deputy Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development to just give us a political briefing on both bills, that he will do the first bill, and then we put questions, clarification, and then he does the next one, and then we'll listen, because he broke the protocol by arriving before me, so I'm going to allow him to go before we finish. No, I think I can cook. thanks very much. Honorable Justice.
Chairperson, thanks. Would it be possible, I think, for the officials that are present to just introduce themselves, or should you want to do that when they start the presentation? This is people from Legal Aid and this people from the department. Okay.
Morning, Chair. Patrick Hundermark, Chief Legal Executive of FarmersLA South Africa.
Morning, Chair. Captain Molari, Legal Support Practitioner, Legal Aid South Africa.
Morning, Chair. Peter Durant, Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, Court Services, and also a member of the Board, Legal Aid Board.
Morning, Chair. My name is Lawrence Bassett from the Department in the Legislation Section.
Morning, Chair. I'm Teresa Rose, also from the Department of Justice Legislation Branch.
Morning, Chair. My name is Dingle Mangana from the Department of Justice Legislative Development Section.
Morning, Chair. I'm Wilma Rowe, Department Legislation.
Chair, thanks. Yeah, and just to say, look, as you mentioned, and I think most of the members of the committee are new, the usual practice has been when there are bills, that it will be the officials that come and do the briefing. I've wanted to change that practice because these bills are not, I mean, the officials will still be doing the briefing and speaking about the technical aspects, but all the bills really, even the more technical ones, are bills from the executive, from cabinet. So I just felt the importance to say a few words on each bill first. There's not too much controversy, I think, with either, but maybe just starting with the first one, the Legal Aid Bill, it's replacing the old Legal Aid Act of 1969, and it's basically come because it's the old Act is pre-constitution, when Legal Aid was quite a different body altogether. Some of the provisions have already been inserted in the 1969 Act relating to recovery of fees and the criteria to be followed, because the Legal Aid has had a well, there have been a lot of court challenges over funding model, which cases could be funded, but basically it's that the bill is replacing the 69 Act, the 1969 Act. Another thing to say about the bill is it's something that Legal Aid South Africa have been very anxious against passed, and they were in fact hoping that it would be passed by the last parliament. Unfortunately, practically it wasn't possible. It's really the first item on the agenda for this parliament. So I think that's all I really want to say at this point. Chair, you may find, I can try and stay a bit, maybe let me move on to the other one, and then you can have the briefings if there are any questions, but I know we can see. The other one then is the Attorney's Amendment Bill. Now this is a sort of short-term bill. We passed the Legal Practice Bill this year. It is with the President for assent. There are some delays. The Honourable Grayson Buck's party wrote to the President raising concerns around the process followed in the National Council of Provinces. So my understanding is that the President's office is looking at that. So that's what hasn't been assented to as yet. But even when it is assented to, most of the provisions of the Act cannot come into effect immediately. There's requirements that a transitional council needs to be established to resolve some of the unresolved issues between attorneys and advocates. That council has 3 years with a little bit of extension to deal with matters. So the legal practice bill will only fully come into effect probably in about 4 years' time. The intention then of the attorney's amendment bill is to deal with certain more urgent issues, and that can be covered in the briefing. The one I just want to highlight particularly is the issue relating to attorneys in former Bokutswana and Venda that are not part of the Law Society of the Northern Provinces, the LSNP. And the LSNP are very anxious for those provisions to be dealt with as soon as possible. And I think at one point we're even talking about legal action to speed up the process to try and force government to pass legislation to that effect. They were though happy for the bill to again come as early as possible in new parliament. So Chair, I think those are the words, that's all I really want to say. I think then there should be then the briefings from the officials going through the greater detail. If there are any questions that people have on the little that I've said, let them ask them, but the details of the bills will be coming in some briefings from the officials.
Thanks, Deputy Minister. Is there anything arising from what the Deputy Minister said that needs to be clarified, or should we proceed straight to the... Thank you very much, it means it's clear. Mr. Advocate, Hazard.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to do the briefing. My colleague, Mr. Paul Malloa, is going to do the briefing itself. There were a few documents that were circulated. I hope members have received them. It's a briefing document. And we thought it was also prudent to make available the Legal Aid Act, the 1969 Act that our Deputy Minister spoke about, so that members can compare what is in the bill and what is in the old Act. We also made available the current legal aid guide for members' information. That's quite a thick document. And with those few words, I'm going to ask Mr. Lowe to do the briefing. This bill is really about governance, and I think these provisions are reasonably straightforward, but I'll hand over to Mr. Lowe. Thank you.
Name of the person, please.
Ms. Velma Lowe.
Oh, Velma, no, my old friend. How are you? Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Legal aid is currently regulated by the Legal Aid Act, which is outdated, and this bill is the product of a task team comprised of the Department and Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 1 provides for definitions. Currently, the Act only defines board and minister, but the bill inserts several new self-explanatory definitions. Clause 2 provides for the establishment of Legal Aid South Africa. It is a national public entity, and Section 1 of the Public Finance Management Act defines a national public entity as a government in business enterprise or a board, commission, etc., other than a national government business enterprise, which is established in terms of national legislation, fully or substantially funded from the National Revenue Fund or tax levy, etc., and is accountable to Parliament.
I don't have a copy of the old Act with the two other members.
Wouldn't it for now suffice if we just listen to the presentation and then we can supply that, because this is not the end of the story. Or unless if someone has an extra copy somewhere. See ya. fit.
Thank you, Chair. Legal Aid South Africa is governed by a board of directors in terms of Clause 2. Clause 3 provides for the object of Legal Aid South Africa. It is to render or make available legal aid and legal advice, provide legal representation to persons at state expense as envisaged in the Constitution, the Act, which is the law, and any other law, and provide education and information concerning legal rights and obligations. In Clause 4 provides for the powers and functions of the board. It is to employ legal practitioners and paralegals and procure legal services of practitioners in private practice, determine each staff establishment and conditions of employment, purchase or acquire or hold or alienate movable or immovable property, hire or let movable or immovable property, fix conditions subject to which legal aid is to be rendered, provide legal representation at state expense and envisaged in the Constitution, the Act, and any other law where substantial injustice would otherwise result. And the new function is the conducting of public awareness programs, and they pay out of funds of Legal Aid South Africa remuneration and allowances to members of the board, their alternates, and any committee members who are not in the full-time service of the state. And then just the general, that they may perform all functions as necessary. Clause 5 provides for the independence and impartiality of Legal Aid South Africa. It says that Legal Aid South Africa is directors, employees and agents must serve impartially and independently. And they exercise their powers and perform their duties and functions in good faith and without fear, fire, bias or prejudice. This is a new provision that's been inserted at the request of Legal Aid South Africa, and they view it as essential to promote the image of independence, that they are not government lawyers, because it often happens that they represent a party that is in litigation against the state. And similar provisions of this nature are in some of the Chapter 9 Institutions Act, and for example the NBA Act and the Language Board Act. Clause 6 provides for the composition of the board. Currently there are 18 members, but the bill provides for 14 members, all to be appointed by the minister. One is a judge, then 8 members who have collectively the skills provided for in Clause 7D, namely business management, information technology, legal services, corporate governance, accounting, auditing, and community-based knowledge relevant to legal aid. Also the CEO, and 3 persons who hold senior executive positions in Legal Aid South Africa. And the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development is a nominee. And the bill provides that alternates may be appointed by the minister and all vacancies are to be filled in accordance with this clause. Clause 7 provides for qualifications for membership of the board. Members must be fit and proper South African citizens, collectively be broadly representative of the diversity of the country, and then collectively have the skills I just listed at Clause 6, and they may not have been convicted of sex, fraud, perjury or an offence under anti-corruption legislation, or an offence referred to in Schedule 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Clause 8 provides for the chairperson and deputy chairperson. The judge will be the chairperson, and then the minister must designate one of the directors as deputy chairperson, and the person will then act as chairperson when the chairperson is unavailable. If both chair and deputy chair are absent, a person elected by the directors present from among themselves must act, and the deputy chair will have all the power, duties and functions of the chairperson. Clause 9 provides for the term of appointment of the board members, the judge, the 8 members, and the 3 legal aid South Africa members hold the term for between 3 and 5 years, as determined by the minister at time of appointment, and they may be reappointed for only one additional term. Currently, in terms of the current act, this period is 3 years, and they can be reappointed, but there's no limit to how many times they can be reappointed. Clause 10 provides for the termination of membership. A director ceases to be a director when he resigns, becomes disqualified, or in the case of a legal aid South Africa employee, leave the employ. And the minister may also remove a director for misconduct, failure to perform, permanent incapacity, or being absent from 3 consecutive meetings without reason or leave, and if a director engages in any activity that is reasonably capable of undermining the integrity of Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 10 provides for meetings of the board. The board must meet at least 4 times per year, and this is in terms of good practice recommended by the King 3 report. Currently, the Act does not prescribe the number of meetings the board must have per year. And then there's provision made for special meetings. The secretary of the board must, at the request of the chairperson or at least 4 directors, of which one must be the judge or one of the 8 members, to convene a special meeting. This is currently also provided for in the Act, but currently the chairperson must convene, not the secretary. Clause 12 provides for quorum. The quorum at any meeting of the board is half of its members plus 1. Currently, the quorum is 8 members. Then the decision must be taken by the majority of the directors plus 1, and the board may determine the procedure of its meetings. Clause 13 provides for the establishment of committees. This is a new inclusion in the bill that is not currently in the Act. The board will determine the powers, duties and functions of a committee. They designate a member of a committee as chairperson and designate another as deputy chairperson. The board may at any time remove a member of a committee or dissolve a committee. The board determines the procedure for the conduct of the meetings of a committee. And this clause is considered necessary for the board's smooth operation. Clause 14 provides for the delegation of powers, the same as in the current Act. Subject to the Public Finance Management Act, the board may delegate any of its powers, duties and functions to any director, committee, employee or agent of Legal Aid South Africa. A delegation or assignment is subject to conditions and directions of the board, and does not divest the board of the responsibility for the exercise of the power of that performance of the duty or function. Clause 15 provides for the appointment of a chief executive officer. All the provisions relating to the CEO are new aspects, as it is not currently provided for in the Act. The board must appoint a CEO. The CEO is appointed for 5 years, which is renewable. The remuneration package of the CEO is determined by the board in accordance with Clause 18, and an acting CEO will be a senior executive of Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 16 is the functions of the CEO. The CEO is responsible for the general administration of Legal Aid South Africa. He or she must manage and direct Legal Aid South Africa's activities, promote and give effect to the objects, supervise its staff, and, subject to the provisions of Section 56 of the PFMI, has the powers, duties and functions that may in writing be delegated or assigned to him or her by the board. Clause 17 provides for the employees of Legal Aid South Africa, and this is a provision that differs from the current Act. Currently the board appoints the employee, but in terms of the role, the CEO must do this. The CEO must appoint in consultation with the board the senior employees, and without consultation with the board, appoint the employee as may be necessary. Then Legal Aid South Africa has the right to operate its offices and justice centers without having to seek accreditation from any law society, and is entitled to employ candidate attorneys subject to provisions of the Attorneys Act. This is the same as is currently the position. And attorneys and candidate attorneys employed by Legal Aid South Africa must be members in good standing of the law society having jurisdiction, and they are subject to the disciplinary control of the law society in question. And this is also the same as the current provision in the current Act. Clause 18 provides for the terms and conditions of employment. Legal Aid South Africa employees and the CEO are employed subject to terms and conditions determined by the board in consultation with the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services and the Minister of Finance. Expenditure arising may not exceed the appropriated budget allocated to Legal Aid South Africa in terms of the FMA. And the employment must comply with basic values and the provisions of the Labour Relations Act relating to collective bargaining are applicable. Clause 19 provides for client privilege. This is a new aspect that's inserted into the bill. A private legal practitioner must, when requested by Legal Aid South Africa, grant access to the information and documents contained in the file relating to the person in question for the sole purpose of conducting a quality assessment of the work done by the legal practitioners. The information and documents remain privileged information against any other party, as information between attorney and client, despite having been made available to Legal Aid South Africa. This clause was inserted at the express request of Legal Aid South Africa to enable them to do quality control and assess whether a private practitioner conducts cases allocated to him properly. Currently, when there is a complaint, Legal Aid South Africa cannot access the case file due to the attorney-client privilege rule. And this can be to the detriment of the client and Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 20 provides for the recovery of costs by Legal Aid South Africa, and this is the same as the current Section 8A of the Act. Whenever Legal Aid is rendered and costs become payable, it is deemed that the litigant or other person has ceded his or her rights to those costs to Legal Aid South Africa. A litigant person, his or her legal representative or Legal Aid South Africa must, at any time before payment of the costs, give the person by whom the costs are to be paid and the registrar or clerk of the court concerned notice in writing that legal aid is being or has been rendered. Legal Aid South Africa must receive in its own name to have those costs taxed and recovered, and the cost must be calculated and the bill of costs must be taxed or agreed that if the litigant or person to whom legal aid was rendered has obtained services of the legal representative acting on his or her behalf in the proceedings or dispute without the aid of Legal Aid South Africa. Clause 21 provides for the finances. The funds of Legal Aid South Africa consist of money appropriated by Parliament and money received from any other source, for example, interest or a cost recovery judgment. The money must be budgeted for, dealt with, managed and accounted for in terms of the PFMI. Chapter 6 of the PFMI deals with all these aspects, and it is applicable. The PFMI applies public entities listed in Schedule 2 or 3 to the PFMI, and Legal Aid South Africa is listed. in Schedule 3 as part, in Part A as a national public entity. The BFMI provides all aspects necessary to ensure proper financial management and it's unnecessary to duplicate it in the goal. Clause 22 provides for the direction for legal aid by court in criminal matters and it is similar to Section 3B of the current Act. This clause prescribes what a court has to take into consideration and what steps must have been taken before it gives a direction that a person should receive legal aid at that expense. A decision by Legal Aid South Africa is subject to review by the High Court, and then there's a new aspect that's inserted that's not in Section 3B of the Act. It's a reference to certain aspects in the prevention of Corruption Act, sorry. Prevention of Organized Crime. Yes, sorry. Clause 23 provides for the Legal Aid Guide and Manual. It's the same as Section CA of the current Act. The bill provides for a manual. This is currently called a guide. The board must compile, review, amend and approve the legal aid manual at least every second year. And the manual will provide mainly for administrative matters. And the manual and any amendments must be submitted to the minister who must table them in parliament and also give notice thereof in the gazette. And it then takes effect 60 days of the publication. Legal Aid South Africa must publish the manual and any amendments thereof on its website and the copy thereof must be available for inspection at all offices. Clause 24 provides for regulations. The Minister must make regulations after receipt of recommendations by the Board regarding types of matters for which legal aid is provided or not provided. Requirements an applicant must comply with to qualify for aid. This is what is called the so-called means test. And the policy relating to approval, refusal or termination of aid. The regulations must be tabled in Parliament by the Minister at least 30 days before they are published in the Gazette. The regulations might also provide that the person who contravenes the provision thereof is guilty of an offence. And there is currently no provision in the Act for regulation. Clause 25 is provided for the repeal of the Act and other legislation referring to repeal the Act is amended to refer to the new law or new Act. Clause 26 provides for transitional provisions. The current board members will be deemed to have been appointed under the bill and they remain in office for 12 months after commencement of the new Act. Also, the CEO and the three persons referred to in Clause 61D, that is the Legal Aid South Africa managers, become members of this transitional board. And the transitional board must, in a period of 12 months, facilitate the composition and appointment of a new board. Legal Aid South Africa requested this to ensure a smooth transition and continuity. The CEO holding office at the commencement of the bill remains in office and is deemed to have been appointed in terms of the bill and is eligible for reappointment. Anything done in terms of the law repealed and which could have been done in terms of the new Act is regarded as having been done in terms of the new Act. Measures regarding remuneration, pension, leave and any other terms and conditions of service continue and apply until they are amended to repeal all assets, rights, liabilities and obligations which immediately prior to the commencement of the Act vested in Legal Aid Board will pass on to Legal Aid South Africa. And the Legal Aid Guide in force on the date of commencement remains in force until it is withdrawn and replaced by regulations and the Legal Aid Manual. The full declaration and legal aid manual must be made and published within 24 months of the commencement of the app. Clause 27 provides for a short title and that the apps will come into operation on a date fixed by the President by Dr. Marsh in the Gazette. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Ms. Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Just in conclusion, this is a bill that we've worked very closely with Legal Aid South Africa, and I'm happy to say that Legal Aid South Africa is happy with the bill. Most of its provisions are, I am aware that there are one or two issues that they would like to see different, but I'm sure they will get an opportunity to present what they feel should be changed, but largely we're happy to say that we've worked closely and they are generally happy with what is presented. Thank you.
I just want to raise a number of issues for your consideration. No, obviously the law provides legal services to their accused persons. But in society, you find that each time people are arrested, you give them lawyers to defend them, and the committees march to the courts and say, don't give them bail, give them stiff sentences. Now it appears that the system as it operates in the eyes of the public, it protects the criminal and says nothing about the victims. And now if such a situation in my view is not addressed, then it delegitimizes the system because the committee will say, okay, we have laws, we have courts, this has to protect the people who are violating our rights. Now, how do we deal with them in that situation? And another issue is that, you know, you have the majority of African people who see justice in terms of restorative justice. That you have arrested these people, you have provided them with legal defense, even if they are convicted. What is in for them? So that justice does not offer them anything. But also when people come out, you want reconciliation between the offender and the victims. But because the victim has not got anything, they won't be inclined to accept the other people. And those practical things. And that brings me to the following point. That when I look at the objects of the law, it talks about attorneys and paralegals. It talks about aid and advice. But in practice, you support the attorneys who are business people. And there's no provision for the paralegals who could set up legal advice centers so that the victims of crime could go and ask for advice as to what are the remedies for them in the circumstances. So I'm just wondering whether we are not dealing with two situations here where you need an attorney to defend the accused, but you need legal advices to address the concerns and of the victims themselves. But also, I'm aware that there is an association of paralegals. Where do they fit in? What support, if any, do they get? Do they have law clinics or advice centers? And if so, what support do they get? Because one is also aware that we are law students want to do community services. And they have nowhere to do community services. But if there were legal advice centers and law clinics, that would be a training ground for lawsuits. So I'm just wondering whether when we deal with this bill, we shouldn't create these kinds of arrangements which would also provide a training ground for young lawyers. But also I see the objects talk about education and information, public awareness, because we have a new constitution that is complex. We seem just to assume that the masses of the people understand it and are able to use it to their advantage. In that regard, what is it that is being done by Legal Aid South Africa to do that education and information, public awareness? Is that not something that should actually also be regulated here? I'm just putting those questions for clarification. Do you want to say something before I open the floor?
Chairman, your questions need to be responded to. Some of it I can respond to. Some of it the officials may be better placed in terms of the detail. But maybe if there are, unless you want a specific response now, or we take other questions and then we can work out who responds. Yeah.
I recognize the Honorable Schwartz, Honorable Mpumlwana, Honorable Horn, Honorable Bonga, Honorable Mpashele, Mtapo, I'm sorry. Let's leave it there. Honorable Majake.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'd just like to ask, what is the benefit of having this board established as a national public entity? I just need to have an understanding of that, number one. Number two, we've now got a new clause about the independence and impartiality of Legal Aid. And I just want to find out, that clause was not previously in other legislation, so it has some implications. And if you consider the composition and appointment of the board, to what degree does the fact that the minister appoints the board impact on the independence and the impartiality? That is something we need to grapple with. I'm not saying it necessarily does. We remember with the legal practice, well, I think the minister played an important role there as well. And then just on the composition and appointment of the board, I see now the organized professions are removed in as much as where previously the GCB would appoint one, nominate one, and the Association of Law Societies would nominate four practicing attorneys. Now it's eight members who collectively have the skills, and then you read that the six sub four invite nominations. Now that could be from anyone. Why have the organized professions been removed specifically for being able to nominate members in as much as they can, but there's no obligation now to accept the nominations from the organized profession, if you read sub 4. I see the board is now smaller, which is not a bad thing necessarily, but what was the reason? Was it saving costs to reduce the size of the board? And in qualification for membership of the board, we've got this new term collectively, which and maybe we could ask the researchers to compare other boards, how they are compiled, because if I understand 7C, be broadly representative of the diversity, that is normally the term that is used. But now we've got a term that's been added, the word collectively, that we need to be aware of. And I know what that means, but why are we adding it in? It's been used a number of times. It's used under 6.1b and 7c. And then the disqualifications under 7e. It seems quite specific. Not having, you know, don't you normally just follow the constitution where a person is being disqualified? Yeah, we've got two specific provisions. We've got a specific reference to the prevention of commencing of corrupt activities. We've got or have been convicted after the commencement of the Constitution. It seems a very specific formulation the person that has been, I just want to know, we need to look carefully at that formulation as well. And would one not also have as a qualification that a person is not declared insolvent, like we've got in terms of the Constitution, those other provisions? It's probably no longer termination of membership. I don't see anything there about insolvency. Is that not something that one should look at? And then obviously the big issue, when the Legal Aid Board appeared before us earlier this year, the lacuna relating to legal aid for commissions of inquiry and the provision of legal aid, is that now covered sufficiently by the provisions of this bill? Thank you, Chair. At this stage, those are my questions. Thank you.
Yes, I do another result. I'm asking the same, similar question. I just want to find out in section 5 of this bill, why must there be such a clause, and what do you mean by independence? Because it's an unruly horse, you know. You may find somebody says, but I can't do anything. What do you mean by independence? And why must be such, we have such a clause? Is it imperative? Is it not I'm trying to find out why not have it, and I hope perhaps I'll have a follow-up question after I've got the answer on that. Secondly, I just want to find the question of the means test that you use. I think in terms of Section 35 of the Constitution, doesn't actually specify. It says if a person has a legal practice applying to the accused, as I say, the excessive, if substantial injustice is otherwise result. Does it mean that if a person has money, but doesn't want or cannot employ a lawyer, will there be, is it related to means test? I understand the reason why there should be means test, but I'm asking because there is this provision position which does not say, are we assuming that because he will not have enough money, therefore there will be injustice? Is that what is being assumed? I understand that the minister will have to determine on certain regulations of that catch. I think let me leave it there.
Honourable Hon.
Thank you, Chairperson. In addition to what I've been asked, I would like to ask the following, or make the following input. In terms of clause 10.2, it would seem as if what is in also in need there is some sort of process in order to remove a director from office. In terms of our constitution and the requirements of fair administrative practice, it's all well and fine that the minister gets the power to remove, but I think the act should also describe the process to be followed before removal. Then secondly, just money in terms of something technical. I'm of the opinion that maybe clauses 15 and 16 should be swapped around, and the new clause 15 should also have something in it to the effect that a chief executive officer might be appointed for the legal aid board. At this stage, it seems as if 15 and 16 is a bit convoluted there, and nowhere the act really establishes the position of a CEO. And then lastly, in terms of the general, the transitional arrangements in clause 26, I think one should also look into it that the transitional arrangements might make provision for the fact that for the first 12-month period, this board will be bigger than called for earlier on in the Act. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And thanks, Deputy Minister. I think I welcome the bill. There is a good piece of work that has been put in here. But my concern, I think, is almost similar to the one of Honorable Mulan and Swart. But I understand the intention of the drafter in terms of the independence, putting the word independence. But our experience of saying legislators is where it's independent, we tend to abuse such words. So I think we may have to look at this way to have careful. My other issue is, I think, it's about the clause number 12. I think the decision must be taken by majority of directors present plus one. So I'm just worried about this waiting. Because if we have a majority that is taking the decision, then the plus one, because I take it that the plus one, it may be necessary for a quorum specifically, but when it is either taken, the majority, just the majority, may have to take petition and moves. And then the other concerns, clause 21. I wonder if we may have to look at the exact version. 21. The clause that speaks of the monies will be appropriated by Parliament, and the wedding afterwards says, and any other source, something like that. We may have to be just very careful. The wedding, because any other source may mean different interpretations. So we may have to get that. But also look at the wedding in terms of what Swart has said. That collective. I think we need to just strictly put things that are not open to other interpretations that we may fail to defend in this investigation. So that collective thing, we may have to look at how do we deal with that drafting there. Yeah, other than that, Chair, I think I'm happy with this work put in by the team. Yes.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Deputy Minister, colleagues and officials. Thank you so much for presentation on political overview and the legal aid bill. However, I've got the following to make. Let me start by commending you on clause 3. It appears very progressive on provision of education and information concerning legal rights and obligations. However, may I kindly take it further that in terms of accessibility of legal aid, let's take into consideration the issue of multilingualism into consideration and accessibility thereof. And may I also be clarified on the issue of manual guide, presently is legal aid guide, and regulation for the Honorable Chair, in terms of contradiction of the two, what will then happen, or the usage thereof, how is this going to be? Because it appears the in terms of clause in the, I think it's 23, it will be manual, no longer guide. And then again we'll have regulations in terms of this bill. And then clause 22, which is section 8A in terms of the current bill, this is a recovery of course. And then may I be clarified under what circumstances and currently in terms of section 8, any success rate. I used to come across Maria King, Service to Correction DM, where there is, section 8A, vis-à-vis the Maria Cake application level, in terms of the recovery of calls, the success rate in that regard. And then last, there's the issue of committees. What type of committees are we talking about here? And then there are only two definitions in terms of the current act. And then now we have these definitions here. And I sort of touch on what the chair has said. In terms of definition of legal practitioner, where there is the exclusion of CA, candidate attorneys and paralegals, how do we tackle that? Okay, I think in most of the, what my colleagues have said, sort of covered me on the budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to thank you for the presentation, Ms. Law. I just want to continue to support the idea around independence. We try and look at independence very carefully. And my concern here is that, you know, lately we actually infuse independence in almost everything that we deal with. Within the budget goals of Parliament. And whatever independence that we talk about should actually also have connected to them a form of accountability. Another area that I wanted to just comment on, the whole issue of loss, the term termination of office, it doesn't talk about termination of the end of the, it doesn't talk about the end of the term of the board member. Where do we talk about this? Because it's very important to have a provision that also takes into consideration end of term of the board member. And maybe it can be covered by regulations as to what processes needs to follow around that time for the end of the term of the board member. Just to avoid the situation in future where you could find that, you know, so many terms have ended and you now have half the board and there's no appointments because there isn't really any clear procedure that's being fulfilled. And then in terms of the meeting says, clause number 11 says that the board must have 4 meetings per annum. How today the board to have quarterly meetings is still 4. But you avoid the situation where maybe within a short space of time the board can have the meetings and after time it's still going to end up being 4 per annum. But you know the meetings are actually in terms of the legislation spread for monitoring purposes throughout the year. There is a clause that said something about the board delegating. I think it's clause number 14. It talks about the board delegating its power to staff. You need to look at it carefully. And it says in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and I think when you talk about how a delegation to staff is the responsibility of the CEO, it means the board actually gets into operations. But the board would actually deal with committees independent. Honorable Tapper just asked you what type of committees. Maybe you could actually also just give directions to the type of committees the board could actually organize. But delegation of power to staff is a competence of the CEO. And you need to look at it very carefully because when you look at other state institutions and the kind of tensions that sometimes exist in those state institutions, this is one area that also creates a problem. You have a CEO, and the CEO has the staff, but you have the board giving instructions to the staff. It brings about confusion within any form of establishment. Clause number 20 talks about litigants ceding powers once they've been, their legal services are being paid for. I don't quite understand that clause. In terms of, it doesn't say ceding their powers, ceding their rights. When does a person forfeit their rights? It's actually makes me get a little bit worried, because they're there to actually go and protect the others, but not to take the eyes away from them. So let's look at it and just maybe craft it in a way that says we continue to protect their rights. Thank you, Chief.
Deputy Minister and honorable members, in the briefings that we get, there's this issue of independence and accountability, which also arise. It appears that also as lawyers, we have not assisted people to understand the meaning of independence. Because I thought wrongly or rightly that the state is a living organism comprising of independent, interconnected, and integrated arms of the state. Now, some definition of independence seem to suggest that people want to operate outside this organism that is the state. And it appears to me that people fear the executive branch of the state, which is established by the Constitution. Now, I think we need to use this opportunity to really clarify what is the meaning of the word independent in constitutional terms. Because if you are going to have the type of independence that removes the duty of accountability, it creates another problem. So I hope that the legal eagles that are here will help us understand that, because it's really creating a problem. Everybody wants to be independent, but independent from whom? Because we can't be islands. We are a constitutional state, and the various parts of it are integrated, interdependent. Thank you.
Chair, maybe let me start on the broader questions, and particularly this one of the issue of independence. But maybe just to say that, look, although the bill is entitled the Legal Aid Bill, it actually is the Legal Aid South Africa Bill. So it deals specifically with this entity called Legal Aid South Africa and what it does, rather than more broadly on legal aid. And that's something that maybe the committee can look at. I did have an email from Professor McGuaid Mason of UKZN, who, and I think when the bill is advertised for comment, hopefully will be making his submission, but was dealing with other aspects of legal aid, university legal aid, that kind of issue. Whereas this bill is, although it's called Legal Aid Bill, it's actually Legal Aid South Africa, the entity called Legal Aid South Africa, and regulating that. So that's maybe something that the committee can look at, whether it wants to rename the bill to make more appropriate the subject matter, or whether it wants to deal more broadly with legal aid. Chair, on the issue of paralegals, I mean, others, the board representatives can speak about the numbers of paralegals employed, but the whole issue of paralegals was something that was meant to be covered by the Legal Practice Bill. And I think in the initial draft of the Legal Practice Bill, there was a section on paralegals. Unfortunately, I think you put a group of lawyers together, and the more lawyers you have, the more arguments and points of dispute. So there's sort of too much in the Legal Practice Bill for argument and debate, and the section on paralegals was taken out. The paralegal organizations did approach the portfolio committee, and the word I'm taking made that there would be legislation passed on paralegals. But that's where paralegals really belong, in an amendment to the Legal Practice Bill rather than this bill, I would urge. Obviously, issues of victim support. I mean, look, there is the constitutional obligation for legal representation, specifically in criminal matters. You know, maybe officials would want to sort of say more about the question of victims, but this is basically primarily for people needing legal representation. As you would have heard, I imagine, from the briefing, there's a constitutional obligation for legal representation in criminal matters where there can be a substantial injustice, but Relay South Africa has been extending its work to civil matters as well. And in those civil matters, sometimes those people could be classified as victims bringing a civil claim against the state and so on. On the issue of independence, I think the issue there, I mean, firstly, its absence from the 1969 Act was a different animal. Then you had the duty care system where legal aid board would use private attorneys from a roster. I think the number of employees who would appear in court were very limited to almost zero.
Two zero.
Now you've got, and it's a much better model because you can cover more people, you have legal aid employing people. You've got to ensure that there is independence because in most cases, in many cases, and probably the majority, they're engaged in litigation against the state. So all criminal matters, it's the state versus the accused. And the accused is being represented by legal aid. You would know, Advocate Fulvane, that many people in communities, as a hangover from fall, will still say, no, they don't want a state lawyer. It'll often be an issue of interpretation in court. I think English would be, you want the state to provide you a lawyer, but sometimes that gets interpreted to a state lawyer. And here's a person who's been arrested, they've been charged with something, the police are, they feel the police are against them, and they then decide, no, they'd be better off on their own without having the state providing a lawyer, because that lawyer is going to be biased in bed with prosecutors, the police, etc. So it's important from that aspect in criminal matters that there's independence, but also in civil matters. So say somebody who is indigent and wants to bring a civil claim against the state, you don't want allegations to be made that a decision was taken not to fund the matter, not to provide funding because the state was involved. So those clauses relating to independence are important in that regard because of the conflict of interest between the state and the organs of the state and the individuals who would be involved in litigation against the state. I think the question of accountability can be looked at. I would imagine, again, the officials can speak more, that the accountability would be more envisaged in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, but that's something that they can respond to and maybe the committee can look at. But it also is the issue of the representation. I mean, maybe just to deal with that one, why is there no representation for organized professional bodies? Again, it's in the past on the board, you had most of the work being done by attorneys and advocates. Now that's very little. And it's possibly, and again the officials can confirm it, it's possibly that if you had people's representing the law societies, the Bar Council, that there may be a tendency to want to see how much can legal aid be used to benefit the members of those associations rather than providing for legal representation. So I just wanted to highlight on those points, but I think that the issue of independence is important because of the conflict between the state, whether it's the prosecutors and the police in a criminal matter versus the person that's accused, and then even in civil matters. Maybe just to say the one other area, and it may require more work, as has been pointed out, there were no regulatory powers in the 69 Act. The guide, which really was wrongly named because it wasn't a guide, the guide is gentle. It was a manual specifying, and that the guide set out the criteria to be followed for when legal aid would be provided. And if you look at that guide would have to be approved by Parliament. Now you've got the guide, which is going to be every 2 years, but you've got the regulations actually specifying the minister must make regulations on the recommendations of, after recommendations from the board, make regulations relating to the types of matters, civil and criminal, in respect that Legal Aid South Africa will provide legal aid, votes, and the limits, and the requirements and criteria to qualify. So the question, I think, relating to Marikana would be covered there in the regulations of the minister, whether a commission of inquiry would be something that there would be legal aid for, and whereas that four would have been in the guide. The guide deals with other issues, so maybe that issue needs to be fleshed out more, given that now you've got two bodies. The guide, obviously, or the manual is approved, it's still approved by Parliament, as far as I recall. It's still approved by Parliament. It was submitted to Parliament, okay. Before it had to be approved. Thought we had to approve it. Sorry? Ratified. Okay, we had to ratify the guide before. That's not done anymore, so that's maybe something that can be looked at. The regulations must be tabled there up to the minister, so that again is something that should be looked at. Just to highlight those points, and sorry, one other point on the independence issue, responding to Mr. Swart. I think we have to, you know, move away from the issue of if the minister or political head can appoint, that those people are not independent. I mean, it's something that seems to be unique to South Africa, a view that if a political head can appoint, those people aren't independent. Whereas in other countries, you will find, I mean, if you look at our appointment process for the public protector, it's what, a 60% majority in the National Assembly. In Australia, the equivalent is appointed by, I think, the Prime Minister or the Governor General, on the advice of the Prime Minister. Whereas, because of this, there's all this sort of suspicion from sections of society that if a minister appoints, those people won't be independent. So I think we need to move away from that. I hope the committee won't look at wanting to write in a role for itself in the appointment of members of Legal Aid South Africa, because if you do, you've got accountability problems. If they mess up, how can you exercise your oversight or property when you helped appoint them? So just to highlight those points. So okay, let me leave it to that and let the officials then answer. But maybe it's also with the Marikana case. I mean, that was useful. That's a kind of issue of independence where, I mean, the whole question of should there be representation in commissions of inquiry when you've got limited funds is something that needs to be debated, because commissions of inquiry don't yield any specific results. Nobody's going to be found guilty of a crime in a commission of inquiry. Nobody is going to be ordered to pay compensation in a commission of inquiry. You've got to then proceed with other actions after that. So it can be then argued that it's not so essential. You need the representation when the person is accused of committing a crime, or you need the representation if they want to bring a civil claim against a private entity or the state or whoever. But the Legal Aid South Africa officials can speak of it. The whole Marikana Commission representation was the board applying its criteria and taking a decision on the basis of that criteria. Luckily, because of that, and because of that independence, there were never any arguments that the state was trying to stop representation, or any arguments that I'm aware of from any serious people. So it is also important that you do allow the independence of Legal Aid South Africa, so that the can't accusations of the state intervening to say don't provide funding in this case, and so on. But the chair, then maybe the officials can go for the other ones.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. You really helped us, because I think there are two situations. The one on conflict of interest is really it should be the approach as you put it, because if you allow the conflict of interest, you are actually creating a problem. But I think what was raised about independence is more about people not wanting the political head to make the appointment. Now, if the political head, the executive cannot appoint, you marginalize them, that's actually changing the entire fabric of the Constitution. I think we have made a very clear and good distinction that it will help us move forward when we deal with the matter.
Before the response, let me just see the questions that I have. I don't have a sense of how far you can go against. For example, if you have a case that is dragging, whether there's any provision, whether it's in a guide, can you just clarify that? Because there could be cases that actually they could eat up the entire budget of the whole year of the UN in South Africa. Do you have a provision that actually manages to avoid that? And also in terms of commissions, if you can comment as to how far in relation to the budget you can go in terms of funding the commissions. Thanks.
Before you respond, Mr. I see another hand, but I don't know who that gentleman is. Can you introduce yourself?
Paul Ramakasa from Economic Freedom Fighters. I'm an alternate of the Honorable Shabalala.
Okay, proceed.
Yes. I was just saying, I think independence protects the state and it also protects us as public, as public representatives. I think we should not look at it as taking away powers of the executive of the president appointing people serving in the legal aid board. Independence should be taken into a proper context of the functions of the board itself. The other point that I want to deal with is in relation to the commission, the point that has been raised by the deputy minister in relation to the funding of the cases in commission. I think that would make us to look into objectives of the existence of the legal aid board, whether it's to give people access to justice, or also is it also to assist the South African victims that any legal process has to include from any activity that is affected a South African who cannot afford a legal representation. We cannot just limit legal aid board to access to justice in relation to court. At the same time, with a person that has to appear before the court and the victim that has to go through a commission, you know, there remain the victims and they need access to the justice system. Therefore, I think we need to debate that to ensure that they are afforded equal opportunity in terms of funding. The last point is accountability. I think it goes without the saying that when we provide any institution with the public money, that particular institution has to account in one or the other. There's PFMA in place, and those institutions like the Legal Aid Board has to write a quarterly report. That must also be audited by the Auditor General. So I think that is those are the points that I wanted to add. Thank you.
In response, before the officials, just on the issue of money, look, the problem is resources are limited. If you provide more money, then Legal Aid South Africa can do more. At the moment, it's got a constitutional obligation to provide representation in criminal matters with a limitation of substantial injustice. With a limitation of the substantial injustice if occurring if there's no representation. So that means obviously the more serious cases. It is trying to extend its work to civil matters because indigent people otherwise don't have access to assistance in a civil matter. It is also providing legal advice through call centres. So people can contact them and they can give more details of that. The more you extend it, I mean, it would be good if it could be representation in commissions and so on. But the more you extend it, the less money there is. And that's the balancing thing. So yeah, I would say Parliament has the power to amend the budget. So if you want Relay South Africa to do more, please give them more money, but don't take it from anything else in justice. Take it from other votes.
This stage. thanks, Deputy Minister. Can we hear Mr. Bassett?
Thank you. I'm going to ask my colleagues to respond, and we're fortunate to have the legal aid representatives here, because lots of the questions that are arising, I think, are about nitty-gritty and they could possibly help. And I think, for instance, about education and awareness, what legal aid South Africa does and what they have in mind with that provision, because that provision was put into Clause 3, I think it is, at their request. So it would be good to hear specifically what they have in mind or what they're already doing about that, because I think some of those, what they respond to there will answer quite a few questions, included here about helping victims. I'm just going to respond broadly to two issues. There was a question that was raised, why are we taking the lead professions out specifically? Quite a few of these provisions in this bill emanate from King 3 report about governance and what is good practice. And the composition of the proposed composition of the board is about precisely about that, to have a smaller board and to take stakeholders who have an interest out of the equation and put experts in there. And that's one of the reasons also why attorneys and advocates are mentioned specifically. But there are also other provisions in the law that deal with governance, and we've looked at the King's Fee report. Just on the manual and the regulations, Chair, as one has already said, we have a quite extensive legal aid guide now that deals with most things. And as the Deputy Minister said, guide is not really the right word, because a guide says what you ought to do. We want something that you must do. And that's why we changed the name from Legal Aid Guide to Legal Aid Manual. And we slipped them redoing regulations for the first time. And your manual is going to deal with administrative issues. But the important things that need to be dealt with in the regulations, as you'll see, what Clause 24 says one must do, must make regulations relating to the types of matters, civil and criminal, in terms of which legal aid is provided or is not provided, or provides limited legal aid and the circumstances in which to do, and the requirements or criteria that an applicant must comply with the means test, or the policy relating to the approval or refusal of legal aid and the termination of legal aid and appeals against refusal and termination of legal aid. The termination of legal aid could relate to what has already been raised, the question was raised, how do you deal with matters that are on and take up all the resources of legal aid. Those will be dealt with in regulations. And why might they be dealt with in regulations and not in the guide as is currently the case is because regulations have force of law, it's a form of legislation. So that's why it's considered important to have those important issues dealt with in regulations. So I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to ask my colleagues to assist me in the other questions.
Thank you, Chief.
My name is Patrick Hundermark. I'm the Chief Legal Executive at Legal Aid South Africa. My colleague, Mr. Spananari, is also with me. I mean, Chair, the Deputy Minister has done very well in terms of dealing with some of the issues, and I wholeheartedly support what he shared with the committee. I think the independence for us is very, very critical in terms of our practitioners, and as he mentioned, you have this resistance in terms of clients saying, well, if the state's prosecuting me, if the state are paying the judicial officer, if the state are paying the police, and then the lawyers being paid by the state. So it's a very much an issue to be able to deal with the independence of the practitioner. You'll see further on in the bill, we also add that all our practitioners are subject to the independent disciplinary control of the law societies. That's one of the further requirements, which goes up further than many other countries, in terms of the independent control of the practitioners by the profession itself. And that's, we've done that specifically because we want to guarantee to the public that when we act for them, we have to act in their best interests, and it's about them as our clients. And specifically that if any of our practitioners had to do anything contrary to professional ethics, they stand to lose their profession as well as legal practitioners. So that's the importance for us in terms of the whole issue of independence. Everyone rightly said the Public Finance Management Act, in terms of our accountability via the executive authority to Parliament, to this committee, to SOFA, in terms of what we do with taxpayers' money, all remain in place. So from that perspective, it's very, very important to note that the PFMA makes it very clear of how we have to account for monies that are given to us by Parliament. I think in terms of the organised profession, we've dealt with it. The whole issue in terms of a board, you look at it in terms of the expertise that you need across an organisation of the nature of Legal Aid South Africa. You need people with legal expertise. You do need people with an understanding of community issues. That's why to have representatives from the community on the board are important. In terms of auditors, accountants, IT specialists, because if you're going to run an overall business, as we do from a legal aid perspective, and run it properly where you can account, you do need that specialization across the board. So if you're going to dominate it with a stakeholder relation, with a stakeholder-based board, like the profession, you're not able to pull in all those resources that you need in terms of running a competent and incompetent oversight for all those issues that an organization requires. In terms of our dealt with that, the means test, Section 35 of the Constitution makes it clear in terms of substantial injustice. I think we've had, and the clause was based in, mostly on the decision of Kanyile, where it's laid down criteria in terms of when somebody faces substantial injustice. And therefore, you face substantial injustice in essence where the seriousness of the offence, you face direct imprisonment, your ability to be able to defend yourself, but also your ability to afford the cost of your legal representation. And that's one of the main criteria. Now, the means test for us is not the be-all and end-all. The means test is an easy administrative tool to determine whether someone is indigent or not. But it's not the defining issue. We do have various processes in place where we look at to determine whether you in fact are able to afford the cost of your legal representation or not. So you may still have a greater income than our means test, you may have more assets, but if you look at the duration of the trial, the complexity of the issues, and the total cost over the duration of the trial, if you run a 10-year trial, very few of us are able to afford it. So it becomes then, in a small percentage of our cases, an issue that we've got to look at the constitutional test. So it's not that the means test becomes in itself the only mechanism that we consider, because we have to comply with the Constitution. The second issue on that is you'll see there's still provision in criminal matters where the court can call to us when we have refused to give reasons why we have refused and to conduct its own investigation to determine whether we should or should not provide legal representation. So there is still oversight from a court on our decisions, and you will also see there's also provision that any of our decisions can be taken on review. So it's not as if we make a decision and then nothing else can happen to it. So those two mechanisms are also still in place for any person that has been refused legal aid to be able to take it further, and the courts will ultimately then decide if that decision has been correct or not. I'm just trying to look and determine. Question 12. I think obviously in terms of the sources of income, it can be. There are sometimes where we would to take some donor funding, but we don't take to run normal businesses, a normal operation, because it's unsustainable. But sometimes we have taken donor funding to test new models of legal services delivery. For example, we had funding to test the use of interns. Can we make use of interns? We've also tested how we link with advice officers and provide up backup legal services to advice officers and how we can link with them. So we've used that as pilot projects to test this and get develop a blueprint to be able to do it. So that being the source of other source of income. So if we need to make that clearer in terms of what we mean by other sources of income, can also be in terms of the cost recovery. In terms of the issue of multilingualism, it's something that I think we can look at in terms of how we've built it. Obviously, we are bound by the constitutional provisions in terms of what we require with the 11 official languages. In terms of the distinction between the legal aid side and what we're having in terms of the regulation. If you have a look at the current legal aid guide, the 2014 guide which has been provided, it's really broken up into two main parts. The one is the policy section. So that deals with the types of matter in both criminal and civil real assistance, how you qualify, the means test. If you exceed the means test, how we can deal with it. The Constitutional Case Management Committee that will then look at these cases where you exceed the means test, but still saying you're not able to afford the cost of your legal representation. So all those policy issues are now being contained in regulations, so which will have input. The manual becomes the procedures part. So what that does is it purely says how do you apply, what forms you complete. So it's an open and transparent process in terms of what you need to complete for the different steps. And that's why we intentionally split the legal aid guide into policy and procedure sections, so that when we move into the bill becoming an act, we're able to easily distinguish between what will go into the regulations and what should be dealt with in terms of the handbook itself, which will really be procedural issues and forms. So I think just to provide that clarity. So that's how the legal aid guide will move into those two sections. Clause 22, the recovery of costs. This is specifically in the issue of civil matters. And that previous clause 8, capital A, and now this clause 22, is if we assist someone to litigate a matter, sometimes, and there are some issues where you find you've now paid the legal practitioner, but they're slowly going to draw a bill of costs in terms of the relevant court tariffs, to tax it and then to recover from the unsuccessful party the money that are due in terms of the costs. And so what this section enables us to do is to step into the shoes of the litigant and to be able to do that for ourselves, to be able to protect legal aid South Africa's interests and ultimately the taxpayers who fund the case, so that we recover those costs where we've been successful in civil litigation. I can give an example where we're busy in the process now, the silicosis matter, where we got compensation for families of my workers that suffered from silicosis. Our costs there were over 10 million, and which we are now seeking to tax and recover so that we can pull that money back in, which obviously goes back into either legal aid or back to the fiscus insofar as it replaces expenses that we've had. So that's really what that clause does for us to be able to then recover those monies on costs. And it doesn't really link into criminal matters, save where we do levy a contribution on persons that exceed the means test. They can't afford the full cost, but they can pay a contribution. Previously, and you'll see the guide does have those provisions in. So we can also levy contributions, and that's what the Act does enable us to do, but that we will then recover direct from the person to whom we're rendering legal aid.
If I may come in, there was also a question on what type of committees do they have in mind, and maybe the legal aid South Africa can tell us what kind of committees they do have up and running at the moment.
In terms of the committees, King Fees is determinative for us in terms of the committee that we have at Legal Aid South Africa. So currently we have a board executive committee, which is then generally responsible for any issues that arise in between board meetings, and they have a delegated authority to deal with that. We have a remuneration and social ethics committee, which then looks and considers any issues relating to remuneration, benefits in terms of employees, and then social and ethical issues in terms of how we impact on society, and consider how we're dealing with that. Then we have the Audit and Finance Committee that obviously deals with all our audit issues in relation to both internal audit, who gives them necessary information from a governance perspective as a board, and they consider that, as well as the external auditors, as well as our overall finances. So you find that your audit committee will deal with those aspects, and also then risk. And then we also have the Legal Services Committee. Now, Legal Services then look at the core of the business. What do we do in terms of rendering of services to clients and communities, and understanding the needs, understanding what we should be doing, getting us to test on different ways of rendering services. Are there matters that we're not doing that we're prejudicing the community that we should do? So that's the four committees that we have. But obviously it's very much in terms of you guided by King 3 And so with these debates, you might have different committees. Sometimes you can have an ad hoc committee to consider some of the issues. So those currently the committee that we do have to have a look overall and from a sustainable business perspective that looks at what, as an organization, are we implementing the business plan that we have put to the board. In regard to quarterly meetings, the only issue with saying you have to have quarterly meetings, it can be restrictive in terms of we align our board meetings to certain deadlines we have in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. So currently, with our meetings, you'll find that our main meeting is specifically directed in terms of making sure our annual financial statements are approved by the board so that we can hand them over to the Auditor General for auditing, because that's a requirement in terms of the PFMA, so we align that there. Then we have to be able to hand over our annual report and our audited financial statements by the end of August in printed form to the executive authority who tables in Parliament. So therefore our board meeting follows it in July so that they can consider the annual financial statements along with the audit report of the Auditor General. So if we have to say quarterly, you'll see just already in that one example maybe a bit restrictive in terms of legislation to dictate that it must be quarterly, because sometimes we need it sooner because of the requirements of the Public Finance Management Act. So that just to respond to the issue of quarterly meetings. I think in regards to the issue of paralegals, and I think I need to then deal with that, in terms of the way we render legal services at Legal Aid South Africa, we employ paralegals at each of our 128 service points, because it's critical that we are able to provide advice. Sometimes a little advice can help someone in the community. Sometimes you can direct them to the correct organization to assist them. You could tell them where to go. You can write a letter sometimes that resolves the issue quite quickly. But obviously if it's a legal matter that requires litigation, then it moves from a paralegal and goes to a legal practitioner. So that's specifically why we have also set up that we have paralegals able to provide that advice. Specifically our satellite offices that are more rural based, we also require them to go out to community points where there's large traffic, whether it's at pension pay points or at other community advice offices, to be able to go deal with specific issues in the communities themselves. Also to go and visit prisons, specifically for persons awaiting trial that may have not been given legal aid, so that we can address that gap in them going through the courts and haven't got legal aid, or they may change their minds, or detained persons who may want assistance with an appeal. So we also have a program to link them then to the prisons as well. So very much the use of paralegals from our service delivery model is critical. In terms of interns or candidate attorneys, we do employ over 600 candidate attorneys. So from an access to the profession perspective, Legal Aid South Africa plays a large role in allowing persons from previously disadvantaged communities access into the profession, and they are able to enter into contracts of articles like they would at any law firm. So from ensuring employment and also then career pathing within the organization, you're able to progress with it, obviously meeting the necessary performance requirements of the more senior position. That's important for us, because you need to be able to ensure that you sustain an organization, because you do have staff leaving, so it's always good to be able to pull from a pool and bring them into the organization where they've done articles with you. So that's very much from Legal Aid South Africa perspective, we've played and will continue to play an important role in terms of access to the profession. Insofar as the recognition of paralegal concerns, the Deputy Minister was correct. I think that's something that's got to be looked at in terms of the legal practice bill. In regard to victim support, it's correct. We do about 13% of our work has grown from 7% previously, is now still legal aid. So in terms of victim support, it becomes a little difficult in terms of victim support. We can assist victims of crimes to seek compensation. But the difficulty becomes is ultimately to be able to enforce any judgment that we may get. Because if the perpetrator is ultimately convicted and sentenced, your ability to go and recover is maybe minimal. And therefore, unless they have substantial assets,
you may be litigating, and one of the issues that we deal with in terms of the diet is we want to take on matters that are not going to be able to give practical effect to, and therefore be able to effect the judgment and be able to get the compensation, because you'll be using taxpayers' money to ultimately then yet not get the result of getting the compensation. I think that's a broader issue that needs to be considered. I think that covers the extent, Chair, of the... Tsipang just points out, in terms of do we deal with advice officers. We have a cooperation agreement with what was called NADCOA, now that's the Paralegal Association of Community Advice Officers, where we meet with them, where insofar as they've provided advice, but now the client needs legal representation, that we have our practitioners going out to their offices to be able to link with the clients and to be able to provide legal representation. So yes, we do have the linkages, although at this stage now we do not fund paralegal advice officers. Okay. Yeah, I think those are the issues, and if I've left anything out, the committee is welcome to ask me.
That's one of your issues, is to provide advice. Now, the legal advice offices provide advice. Is there any reason why you can't fund them for doing what you are supposed to do?
I think it becomes the question then, yes, of money, and also in terms of whether that is one of the functions that we do have in to fund advice offices. If that is then pertinently given to us, that we should fund advice officers and deal with it, with the required accountability in terms of VFMA. But then it's, we would then require appropriate funding to enable us to do that.
Chair, Peter Durock from Justice, just to add on some of the aspects, I think we also need to bear in mind that there is a national call centre that provide advice. People can phone in and they get assistance immediately, either by a paralegal, etc., or they are referred then to a lawyer that can give more substantive advice if required. So in that sense, I think on an annual basis, quite a number of people are assisted. It's in the hundreds of thousands of people that are assisted in this way. So I think there's also a role in that, in giving advice in that sense. But I think there's also, I think, some of the other questions that was posed, for example, restorative justice and those sort of things. Legal aid, when they deal with their issues at a court level, are involved with those processes in conjunction with the prosecutors and the other role players at court, trying to find an equitable type of sentence, etc., to deal with those sort of things, if it's a sentence, or even where they need to deal with aspects in a different way, for example, diversion, etc., things like that, mediation, things. They are all involved with those sort of processes, so I think in that sense there is, I think, some assistance in making sure that the community and victims' rights are more brought to the fore. I think, in addition, part of the aspect that is covered in terms of public education, etc., is to make people aware of their rights and things like that. And I think that is a further element of assisting victims and the communities in trying to understand how does BOLE work, how does the legal processes work, how can they get assistance in terms of these sort of things. But Legal Aid South Africa has gone one step further, and they put a unit within the organization that deals with impact litigation. And in terms of the impact litigation, you look at how can you, through one case, for example, benefit many people. And there, victims in particular, you mentioned the silicosis type of cases, etc., where you've got a large number of victims of society that can be assisted through one type of case. And that type of thing, I think, is also important. Children in particular is a, and other vulnerable groups are being assisted by Legal Aid South Africa. In particular ways, we're monitoring their remand detention, we're monitoring what's happening in terms of children that comes in conflict with the law, part of the programs, etc., that are set up from the state side, involved with making sure that the programs are effective, etc. So there's a range of those things where Legal Aid South Africa does provide a service to the victims, etc. I thought we just need to look at that angle as well. Thank you.
Sorry, maybe I must deal up. There was a specific question on the education which Mr. Harun reminded me of. From a Legal Aid South Africa perspective, it's also important to be more proactive on various levels to the issue of rule of law, and secondly in terms of understanding that the community can understand where we are, how they are linked to us. So what we have is what we call is a fair play event at schools, where we link with obviously the schools, the school children, and also the teachers at the schools. So we have at each of our data centres a program where they link to schools and different schools every year. You can't do all the schools in one go. And in terms of linking the issue of rule of law to sports of soccer or netball, so that children understand, just like in sport, that if you do something wrong you can get a yellow card or a red card. So in society the same happens, and to understand those issues in terms of rule of law from a proactive perspective, and then also to understand where they can reach us from a Legal Aid South Africa perspective, because that's one of the things that becomes important, that when they do need us, that they know where they can make contact with us. So that's also one of the proactive programs from an education perspective where we involve it. So there's quite a few different programs that we have, but I thought I'll just mention that as an example.
I think it will be the last. I think we need to move on to the next bit, otherwise we'll run out of time. Unanswered questions.
So it's 7E, that formulation for 7E on disqualification for membership of the board. Why did it formulate it like that? And can I, is 7A, if you fit the proper person, does that mean that a fit the proper person is someone that has no criminal conviction? Is that correct, or if not, then why have we got that strange formulation? Because in other words, a person that is found guilty of kidnapping, corruption, murder, prior to the commencement of the Constitution, can still serve on the board, or an infringement of the Companies Act. We spoke about Kingsley, insolvency. You've specified three activities, theft, fraud, perjury, or an offence under prevention and combating of corrupt activities. That's the only offences that will apply before the commencement of the Constitution. Subsequent to the, you referred into Schedule 1. So I just wanted some idea of that. We've used, if I remember correctly, the legal practical, we used the constitutional formulation, Section 47 in the Constitution.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the distribution of meetings throughout the year, because the suggestion was that it should be quite a limiting, since you're actually indicating certain requirements that may actually require the board to be meeting at certain periods. I think it's very important, because also you mentioned that the whole submission of balance sheets and having to look at audited financial statements, which is understandable. But also, my point was about really you having the ability to meet enough throughout the year, so that you know the meeting are not clustered around just the one year. It's something that you can go look at, so that we actually manage to make that kind of an alignment. I didn't share the response on the delegation of responsibility to past members by the board, because that is another point that I raised. What was the last one? Okay. I think that's fine.
Well, I just wanted to say, I think, Honorable Deputy Minister, that Legal Aid has got an option in changing that. In my language, when you say Legal Aid, it's Amakotanamul Bank. Lawyers of government lawyers. I mean, even the magistrates have that. You want the government lawyers, they're able to have your own lawyers. If you think so by putting the independent, yes, it's to make people change, I think it's going to have an uphill. You need more education than that and change the name somehow. Thank you.
Sorry, Jefferson. Sorry. Yeah, sorry, I just want to add my words that my issues also have not been responded, and specifically the one I raised regarding the fact that there must be obviously an inquiry first before a director might be removed, and that's absent in the act.
We should let us have some reports on the Justice Centre. How many are they? Where are they? And this linkages with prisons and the services to children, because the question may arise from the National Development Plan to say you want an active citizenship. Are some of these things not things that can be done by community-based structures? Shouldn't you maybe look at using some resources to support the community-based structures so that the people themselves do these things, other than government trying to do everything, because it will never have enough capacity? But we want to look at your reports before we make an informed opinion.
Thank you, Chair. The questions that haven't been responded to, I would like to suggest that we as a department will go back and have a look at those. I think those are technical in nature. The question surrounding collectively, we suggested that we look at the composition of other boards, disqualification, as Mr. Swartz mentioned, insolvency, as I mentioned, we'll come back on those, we'll revisit those. And the due processing clause 10.2, we'll have a look at it. It sounds like something we can do, convoluted. Clauses 15 and 16, we'll discuss it with law advisors. The clause 12 dealing with majority, we'll also have a look at, as well as clause 10, termination should include end of term office, we'll have a look at that, and we'll also have a look at the delegation to the CEO rather than staff. But those are things I think that they're useful suggestions, and we'll go back and deal with them.
Deputy Minister, I think we are happy with the briefing. We'll leave it there. And thank you for your attendance and guidance. I'm advised that there's tea outside. If you'd like to just pray for 5 minutes and comfort.
From the other side, they left land or what I call the Risha Kuru and the Japan to buy. I don't know how many years Panama. If you go to Islam, Panakula, I think there was the main show plan over to farm. And then it was better than
the other. Oh, they
wanted. And then there was right in front of the room, prepared right now. I think there is a plan. The check up,
That's
in the cool next time. Well, oh, no, I know the area very well. Right now, it's the man of Chuja Pastor.
Oh.
I saw that on a maybe around 10 years over.
Oh, yeah,
Thank you.
Honorable members, Honorable Mpumlano, you are welcome to this meeting. We let the Honorable President who has been so peaceful, we are welcome to this meeting. even when my active and making contributions. Yeah, and I want to apologize for keeping a cap on, my head is cold. Can we allow Mr. Advocate Bassett to give us a briefing?
Thank you, Chair. My colleagues are going to do the briefing. Mr. Lingon Mangena and Mr. Teresa Ross, I'm going to hand over to them immediately. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The next bill that we're going to talk about is the Attorney's Bill, Amendment Bill. But first we need to talk about the background to this very bill, as to why it was suggested that it be brought into being. First of all, the real aim is to amend the Attorney's Act 1979, Act 63 of 1979, as an interim measure pending the implementation of the Legal Practice Bill. Background to the problem the bill seeks to address, after being declared independently, the former Republic of Transkei, Botswana, Venda, and Ciskei enacted their own legislation regulating attorneys. These laws of former homelands are still applicable in the areas for which they were enacted. In 1998, the Act was amended in terms of which attorneys practicing in the former Botswana and when they were deemed to be members of the Law Society of Northern Provinces for the purposes of obtaining indemnity cover under the Administrative Liability Fund. And so the Law Society of Northern Provinces was tasked with issuing Fidelity Fund certificates to attorneys in these areas. The Law Society of Northern Provinces was granted concurrent jurisdiction with the Law Society of Botswana and Venda over disciplinary methods of the attorneys in this area. This was mainly to protect members of the public who are blind to these attorneys. So this 1998 amendments were intended to be a temporary measure pending the rationalization of the legal profession through the legal practice legislation, which will be enacted in future. The concurrent jurisdiction exercised by the Law Societies of Northern Provinces over the attorneys in Botswana and Venda marked the beginning of challenges experienced by the Law Societies of Northern Provinces, particularly in the former Botswana jurisdiction. Some of the challenges experienced include the following: lack of disciplinary and regulatory control. Cases of unprofessional conduct are not properly investigated, and the Botswana Law Society does not cooperate with the Law Society of the Northern Provinces in the investigation of disciplinary matters. Another challenge was that candidate attorneys in the jurisdiction of the Botswana Law Society are not required to attend the practical legal training course, which is compulsory under the Act. The Act, moreover, allows candidate attorneys who attend the 6-month practical legal training course offered by the Law Society of South Africa to claim a reduction of 6 months from their 2-year period of articles of clerkship. Candidate attorneys in the former Transkei, where the Transkei Attorneys Notaries and Conveyors Admission Act of 1934 still applies, do not enjoy this benefit. And you know that this is a problem already. There has been continuous litigation where the Supreme Court of Appeal has reprimanded the Botswana Law Society over its reluctance to deal with the legitimate complaint by the public, and have even questioned whether the continued existence of this law society is desirable in the public interest. These problems have increased the need for stability in the attorney's profession, particularly in the former Botswana. Now, what about the practice legislation. The department and parliament have not been in favor of ad hoc amendments of the act. They wanted to actually be in a one-off mechanism when the legal profession or the legal practice legislation comes into being, which will rationalize the legal profession and also address the challenges experienced in relation to regulation of the ADMIS. The implementation of the legal practice legislation, which adopts an incremental approach, of course will take time. That's why this bill has to be enacted as soon as possible to actually safeguard the interests of the public at large out there. The department has continued to receive representation from LSNP and the Local Society of South Africa requesting that the Act be amended urgently in order to address the problem surrounding the regulation of attorneys in the form of Botswana, even after the introduction of the legal practice bill into Parliament. These problems have not manifested themselves in the former render. It is therefore necessary to urgently promote the amendment as an interim measure, pending the implementation of the legal practice legislation in the interest of the legal profession and to protect the members of the public who are clients of attorneys in the form of Botswana. So that's very, very, very important and very pivotal to why this bill was enacted in the first place. So now, coming to our discussion, most of the clauses of the bill aim to, at the most, terminate the continued existence of those law societies still operating in the former TBBC state. TBBC will be transferred to the Zona Benda and Biscayan state, and which, it is understood, are empty shells, and certainly to incorporate them in the mainstream law society. However, there are other amendments not actually related to the 2 points that I've just cited below, but which are very important and very fundamental in addressing the transformation of our transformation of the legislation governing the profession. The first one that we'll talk about is Clause 3. Clause 3 actually addresses Section 3 of the Act, which provides for the categories of attorneys who may engage and retain candidate attorneys for the purposes of articles of flagship. You will note that in the legal profession, there's what we call professional assistants, who are attorneys who are admitted to practice the profession of attorney in a private law firm. So, in Section 3 of the Act, they do not include professional assistants in the category of attorneys who may engage candidate attorneys. And attorneys of similar status employed in the state attorney's office, Legal South Africa and Law Clinic, are entitled to engage candidate attorneys, which to us is an anomaly which needs to be remedied. So the proposed amendment in Clause 3 is intended to ensure that similar to their counterparts in the state attorney's office, Legal Aid South Africa and Law Clinic, professional assistance in private practices are also entitled to engage candidate attorneys, and this will broaden the pool of persons who can engage and train candidate attorneys, thereby increasing the number of persons who are able to enter the legal profession. Clause 14 actually remedies Section 19 of the Act, which states that a person who intends to apply to the High Court for admission as an attorney must give notice of such intended admission to the Secretary of the relevant law society. Currently, the Act does not make a distinction in notice periods between new applications and applications for readmission as an attorney. While a short-term period may be justified in processing new applications, a longer period is required to process applications for readmission to the legal profession. There may be issues that the law society in question may need to investigate before it can support and process the application. 1 month notice is regarded as so insufficient for such an investigation. So, therefore, Clause 14 of the bill aims to increase the notice period of applications for readmission to 3 months. 15, subparagraph A, deals with Section 50 of the Act, providing that a person who was admitted and enrolled as an attorney, notary, and conveyancer under this Act may apply to the registrar of any court other than where he or she was admitted to have his or her name placed on the roll of that court so that he or she can also appear at that court. This has a very fundamental problem in the sense that it actually negated the tenets of the Constitution in the sense that it discriminated unfairly against the attorney who were admitted in the QTBBC state. And the notable judgment in the Constitutional Court in the case of Mabaso versus Law Society of the Northern Provinces and the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development held that under this Act, discriminate unfairly against attorneys admitted in the former TBBC state. So, basically, this clause 15A, paragraph A, this clause merely gives effect to the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the case of Mabaso by covering attorneys admitted in the former state, TBBC state. And then clause 16 deals with section 23, subsection 1, subparagraph A of the Act, authorizing attorneys to practice as an incorporated company. Section 8, subsection 3 of the New Companies Act 2008 prohibits an association of persons from carrying on business that has for its object the acquisition of gain unless that business is registered under the Companies Act. The third section of the Act defines a profit company among others as a personal liability company if it meets the criteria for a private company and its memorandum of incorporation states that it is a personal liability company. A private company is defined in section 8 subsection 2, the paragraph B of the Companies Act, a company that is not state-owned and its memorandum of incorporation prohibits it from offering any of its securities to the public and restricts the transferability of its security. An incorporated company as provided for in the Act is not recognized under the Act. So clause 16 does away with the requirement that the memorandum of incorporation of the practice registered as a company must state that all past and present directors of the company shall be jointly and severally liable for its debts and liabilities. So the proposed amendment will also ensure that a practice is registered as a personal liability company. Section 23, subparagraph 1, subparagraph C of the Act provides that the name of an incorporated firm of attorneys can only consist of names of former or current directors of that firm. And according to the Law Society of Northern Provinces, some of the largest firms in its area of jurisdiction have entered into arrangements with overseas firms in terms of which the name of the foreign firm is used as a trade name. This arrangement is incomplete with the provision of Section 23, subparagraph 1, subparagraph C of the Act, as overseas firms do not have the past or current directors in the local firm. That the loss of the LSNP and the profession nationally is of the view that use of the name foreign firms as a trade name by local firms is justified as it allows its members to gain experience and compete in a global arena. The amendment contained in clause 4 will also allow the Council of the Law Society to approve the use of any name as a trade name which could include the name of a law of an overseas law firm. So in South Africa we've got numerous firms that actually already practice there. One notable example would be Dennis Ree, which has changed his name to Norton Rose. The former Rutledge Udise is now, I just forgot the name, but he changed his name to the name of the overseas firm. I just forgot the name, but it happened and it's happened. So So that clause seeks to actually change the confirm it as such. So the word membership is only used in context of not-for-profit company or close corporation. The Act uses the term member instead of a shareholder. The proposed amendment in 16 is also aimed at correcting this terminology. So that will be clarified when the final document comes about. So clause 19 seeks to amend section 49 of the Act, which requires any action against attorneys by the Liberty Fund to be instituted in the High Court. We all know that litigation in the High Court is quite expensive. And if a matter can be brought in the lower court, which is far less expensive than in the High Court, the question, in the High Court, so people will be afforded an opportunity to actually ensure that their rights are protected, and they can ensure that at least whatever damage that they have suffered is rectified or repaired with minimal incurring of the cost. So the question that one would ask is that why should litigants be forced to approach the High Court? Basically, there is not much reason for them as to say people must only approach the High Court only as the only court that can actually hear matters that are brought against it as an inspired one. Therefore, clause 19 amends this section by allowing actions against the actionist fidelity fund to be instituted in any court, in any court having jurisdiction and not necessarily in the High Court. Clause 21, this clause aims to amend section 56 of the Act by providing the continued existence of the four societies under their present name, namely the Law Society of the Cape of Good Hope, the Law Society of the Orange Free State, the Law Society of the Transvaal, and the Natal Law Society. This law provides that these societies may, by resolution of their members, change the name of the society. It provides unambiguously that these societies have jurisdiction over all attorneys practicing in their areas of jurisdiction as follows. So the Law Society of Cape of Good Hope will have jurisdiction over all attorneys practicing in the Western Cape, the Eastern Cape, including the Transkei and the East Sky, and the Northern Cape. The Law Society of the Orange Free State will have jurisdiction over all attorneys practicing in the Free State. And the Law Society of the Transvaal has jurisdiction over all attorneys practicing in Gauteng, Mpumalanga, the Northwest, including Bophuthatswana, and Limpopo, including Benin. And lastly, the Natal Law Society has jurisdiction over all attorneys practicing in KwaZulu-Natal. Thus, Clause 21 further provides that any law society not mentioned under the categorization that I've just said will dissolve in accordance with regulations made under Section 81 of the Act. The clause, again, contains the most important element which is required for a seamless transition from one to the other dispensation, in that it contains transitional arrangement for assistance by providing that any rights and obligations, pending actions and disciplinary inquiries of the societies which are dissolved are transferred. For example, in this case, the Law Society of Transvaal will actually incur all those in the cases of Bophuthatswana and the Law Societies. And other law societies will do the same. For example, the Law Society of Cape of Good Hope will actually inherit all matters pertaining to the rights and obligations, pending actions and disciplinary inquiries of the former Transkei and the Biscay Law Society. So that's a very important arrangement that is in place. That Clause 21 is to sell over the powers that be, that it be considered as such. Clause 22, the amalgamation of the former homeland societies of law into four former RSA law so that it will result in us becoming members of different law societies to the ones of which they are currently members. This will require the new law societies to have proper and updated records of practitioners in their areas of jurisdiction. Therefore, clause 22 amends section 57 of the Act to make it obligatory for practitioners who become members of a law society for the first time to provide that law society with information as may be required. So this is basically for the purposes of establishing a data register for all the practitioners in the country and to ensure that the profession is adequately regulated. And clause 24 deals with section 71 of the Act, which deals with the right of the council of a law society to inquire into alleged unprofessional or dishonest or unworthy conduct of attorneys. On the other hand, section 15, subsection 1 of the Act provides that right for a court to admit or enroll any person as an attorney if, among others, that person is fit and proper to be so admitted or enrolled. So clause 24 amends section 71 of the Act to make provision for the council of a law society to inquire into the alleged unprofessional or dishonest or unworthy conduct of an attorney irrespective of where and when the alleged conduct took place, or whether it occurred before or after that person became a member of its society or not. So in other words, it will prevail all over the show within the four corners of our republic. So clause 26 will deal with section 75 of the Act limiting the ability of law society in respect of anything done in place under the Act. So section 59 of the Act gives law societies the power to conclude an agreement with any person for the performance of any work or to render business. So clause 26 of the bill aims to extend the limitation of liability to agreements which were concluded under any law repealed in terms of clause 35 of the bill. So that again is very, very important because it just enforces that which was there before. Our clauses in conclusion that are very necessary to talk about are clauses 1, 3 to 10, 12 to 18, 22 to 25, 28 and 30, which give effect to the view that law societies are not necessarily bound to specific provinces. Clauses 1, 2, 7, 11 and 19, 25, 28 and 29 aim to amend the provisions of the Act, which still refer to concepts such as the Supreme Court, provincial divisions, local divisions, and the like, so as to put them in line with the current realities. So at the moment, we're still using most of the names which were used in the year. So it's very important to fast-track these changes so that they must be in sync with the current situation. So clauses 20, 27, 31, and 32 repeal Section 55, 77, 84, and 84 capital A of the Act, which have become obsolete because they contain interim measures relating to the former homeland, of course, homeland died a long time ago, and also linked to this clause is clause 34, which extends the Act to the entire country. So if the Act is extended to the entire country, simply, you know, with logic, dictate that all other legislations should not come into consideration, but only that one Act which all practitioners in the country need to be governed by. So the transitional arrangements, again contained in clause 7 of the PIC, which is again an important addition, is aimed at protecting the interests of the candidate attorneys whose rights of appearance were issued by the law societies, which will be amalgamated as a result of the bill. The right of appearance of this candidate attorney will be valid for 5 years, from the commencement of the bill or for such a period as may be determined in the legal practice legislation when it is implemented. And lastly, what is very important is that clause 35 refers to former common legislation, and that's very, very important. So with that, I'd like to say thank you. If there are questions, then those can be posed. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a thorough presentation. You must have spent a lot of time in thinking and connecting and disconnecting things.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, there is a presentation. Honorable Schwartz.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Reading the judgments, the serious comments by the SEA and the Constitutional Court, and particularly the SEA against the not only the litigants at the Philip Swanner Law Society, are an indictment on us that it's taken such a long time for the piece of legislation. Maybe we can get an explanation, because I see in one of the judgments it was served on the Minister's office. And I appreciate that we've been dealing with, we dealt with a legal practice for over a long period, and it might have, the thought might have been that this issue might have been dealt with then. But I see the one judgment was in 2004, or again, we've got judgments in 2009, and it seems to be an unacceptable turf war that is going on between the Northern Province Law Society and the Botswana Law Society, and that has resulted in these indictments by the SCA, where the court referred in fact to dishonest behavior and reprimanded the Botswana Law Society, and saying that it's sad that they have not only to deal with the conduct of practitioners, but also with the law society, and that the responsible members of its executive run the risk of disciplinary proceedings against itself. So I'd like to know, firstly, what is the situation at the moment with the Botswana Law Society? Those judgments were done some years ago. Is there cooperation? Has it been resolved? One would probably think not, the turf war and the interpretation of the conflicting statutes. But secondly, why has this bill taken so long to get to us, considering that the courts, Reagan J. and Master from the SEA, suggested legislative intervention a number of years ago, and it's a sad indictment on all of us that it's taken such a long time for this issue to be addressed by Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the thorough presentation. My only concern, Mr. Chair, is that it's stated that the Botswana Law Society opposes this proposal, this amendment, and I'm not sure if the current status is of that law society. Is it functional, but it still exists? Is it an actual opposition, and do we need to look at that issue any further, or just need a little more information in that regard?
I also want to thank you for having thought about this case of unified, U.S. on campus of uniformity. I just want to find out what happens to the right. I know, for example, in the Transkei Act, if you are an attorney, you would automatically be a convert. Yes, definitely. No, wait a minute. You would do convert, keep your attorney. I think that there was some kind of a clue on the word. What happens to the people, because you are saying in section 33 that any person who immediately before the commencement of the decree being a tenured minister was admitted and entitled to practice as a practitioner in terms of those laws, I want to allow, make that person now go and is it covering? Does it cover that? That's what I want to do. Does it cover people who have certain rights? It may not be those only, there may be others, but I don't know, which are different. I assume that they will continue having those rights.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for the presentation. And indeed, amendment is long overdue because we hear it with us into democracy systems of the past that are really dividing the whole country. So basically, this thing of doing piecemeal amendment, I think it's not a good idea. It would be good just to do total amendment and repeal of some of the acts that are not really capable for us. First number 21, you're actually saying that the current form should have continued existence. And then you have the names, the law society of transfer. Is it not better to align it with the boundaries that we really call them? Because transfer is what used to be the old order. I don't know if, yeah, so wouldn't you be in the position to just change it so that it then makes sense as to what you refer to when you say the law society of the area? Thank you, Chair.
Is a mockery in this moment of democracy to still have law society of Botswana, and to take from what my colleague here, Honorable Dylan Majake, has said about the four old order provinces. I know with the render, it's not a such a regular problem, isn't it? With render. No, no, it's not the same. It's not the same. It has improved, I mean. And then there may be what is before us here is the issue of legal jurisdiction, isn't it? Yes. Because when coming to issue of viability certificate, they go to LSNP, isn't it? But you know, when coming to this issue of unprofessional or unworthy conduct, that's where the problem lies. So I'm a bit concerned, as much as my colleagues are, because there has been this section 84(a) of the current Act, which gives concurrent jurisdiction. However, there may be misconceptions when having to, they might think the attorneys in the then, as one misconception of section of section of this new the judgment by CC, thinking maybe it's a sort of condonation of law society of Botswana. So I appreciate this bill, despite it having taken such a long time after a sense of judgment by SAC. Because if you read through this judgment, although they were not precisely clear on law society of Botswana, they were more focused on the conduct of individual attorneys. However, the bill is long overdue. Long overdue. That's why it is a mockery of our democracy to still have this board of society of Botswana and so forth. And then what I would like to know, what is obtaining now in Transkei and Ciskei? Then Transkei and Ciskei. Do we still have such things as law society of Ciskei or law society of Transkei? Or are they part of what you are calling, what do you say? Cape of Good Hope. Oh. Okay, thank you, Jeff.
No, thanks, Jefferson, and thanks for a thorough
presentation. Chair, I don't have any problem. I think it is quite clear that these measures are initial measures whilst we are waiting the implementation of the legal practice period. And I think the reasons given, all reasons given, are quite substantial, and I fully support this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we need to welcome the presentation and also concur with my colleagues that the amendment is long overdue. And my question would be, how soon can this be passed and implemented to avoid maybe further judgments against the competing organizations with the same objective, but still, you know, linked to the previous apartheid borders called Botswana and others. And one other thing would be, in repealing some of the law, proposing amendments, we must also try to align our arguments or stick to the current demarcations. Like, for instance, if you go into page 9, where they were talking about amendments of section 56 and talking of specific law society of different provinces, like in the Free State, they are still talking about the Region Free State, and there is now something called Region Free State now, as far as I know. We are having the Free State. Thank you, Chairperson.
How fast the bill can be passed is something that rests with us, not with the Commission. And we have a program that we'll share on how we're going to do it. Honorable Mpumulana?
Yes, I said.
I forgot to ask. I understand that these people, the Botswana lost sight, are just to the same. Did they make any presentations to you? Okay. Just for your sake, if they did make any presentations to you, because you don't seem to have covered them with a short they are also.
My colleague is going to respond. What I should have said right at the beginning, and I just like confirmation, what we submitted together with the briefing document was also the Attorney's Act as it reads at the moment, so that members can refer to it to see the amendments in their context for their benefit. And we also emailed the judgments that have been referred to the ACA and the Constitutional Court for the benefit of the members. I just wanted to make that point, but I'm going to ask Ms. Ross and Mr. McGenna to assist with the responses.
Thank you
very much, Chair.
Before you begin.
Thank you very much. Let me first start by addressing the question of the names, notably under Clause 21. That was only states that the present name, the names that are currently in place will be used up until the members of those societies converse and come up with a name. So in other words, this does not impose names over those societies, and it affords members to actually come and own up to that society by giving it its rightful name. So, like I said earlier on, this is just an interim arrangement, but as soon as the bill passes, then the ball will be set rolling and societies will be expected to come up with names that will actually mirror what we represent currently. And the how soon part by the Honourable Member on this, we would love it to be as soon as possible. Yes.
And then regarding the issue of the misconception of, about the judgment and all that, there was misconception about judgment. The judgment only injuncted us to say, or interpreted that by effectively admitting or choosing to admit attorneys or excluding attorneys from the previous individual state, we are actually unfairly discriminating them. So as a result of that, we are forced to actually change that outlook and actually treat them as our equals, as the constitution of our country so dictates. So that's the gist of what that judgment was actually forcing us to have a look at. So we are forced not to discriminate, and if we continue as a country, then we will be said to be discriminatory by excluding them. So we need to come to the point as well.
Question was raised on what is happening with the Bokudatswana Law Society. Chairperson, when we, or perhaps even linked to the question is why the delay since the judgment by the FCA as well as the Constitutional Court. When these judgments were pronounced, and that was the time when the Legal Practice Bill was being prepared and consultations were ongoing around it. And the view was not to deal with the regionalization of the legal profession in a piecemeal manner, but rather to comprehensively deal with the matters. And the Legal Practice Bill itself, the consultations around that took longer than we had expected, but the view was, even in the department, the view was that amendments rationalizing the legal profession should not be dealt with on an ad hoc basis. And the Bokudatswana Law Society, the question was, what is the current position? We're not certain of what is happening there, but the Law Society of South Africa, even in the past month, inquired from us how far the amendments are, because the problems in the former Bokudatswana area are still ongoing. After we prepared the bill, the minister wrote to the Law Society of Bokudatswana. We are not sure where they conduct their business from. We tried to contact them and then we sent the letter, and that was in 2018. And we requested them to respond to us on the amendments by 30th of August back then. And up until now, we haven't heard anything from them. And also what we learned from the Law Society of South Africa together with the Law Society of the Northern Provinces is that the Law Society of Bokudatswana actually has not given resources, and there is only one individual working there. So we really, you know, not sure about the workings of that, and that is what also accelerated the need to come up with this bill, despite the Legal Practice Bill going to be enacted at some point.
Can I just come in on this point as well, that Ms. Ross is dealing with, maybe she is going to deal with it, and I don't have the exact time, but I've got a feeling that it was shortly after those judgments, and I dread to speak under correction, but we did bring amendments to Parliament, and they, for some other reason, those amendments weren't promoted, dealing with the rationalisation. So there have been attempts, and it was, I think, as we say in the briefing, Parliament and Department at that time were involved with sensitive negotiations around the legal practice, for realizing that to try and force rationalisation then might have been problematic with negotiating on a legal practice all itself. So I thought I must just, there has been amendments that have been brought to Parliament when I cannot quite recall. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, another question that was raised was around the issue of the Law Society of Northern Provinces issuing fidelity fund certificates. As already indicated in the briefing, there was an amendment in 1998 in terms of which the Law Society of Botswana and the Law Society of the Northern Provinces were given concurrent jurisdiction over the regulation of attendees in that area. Mainly because the Law Society of the Northern Provinces was better placed to deal with the control over trust funds. And we are made to believe that that has been going well, except for the part on the disciplinary issues when it comes to the conduct of the attorney there. On the question of what happens to an attorney who qualifies as convincer on account of being admitted as an attorney. Maybe, you know, that is something that we'll need to look at. What this bill also does is to repeal the legislation. And the bill repeals the Transkei and the vendor and all those, you know, former homeland legislation. So the bill aims to have the Attorneys Act applied uniformly throughout the country. So that will have to be governed by what is contained in the Attorneys Act.
There was a question raised, what is the status of Transkei and Swisskei law societies? I think they exist in name only, and the same applies to Venda. Transkei and Swisskei law societies exist in name only. They're not functional, and the same applies to Venda. I think the only real problem that we have lies in Botswana, and that also seems to be the functioning thereof via the Department of Commerce. It's extremely difficult to find out, as Ross has said, exactly what is going on and to try and contact them.
They exist in name only. Who is the controlling body there? Are they just on their own as losers?
What happens there, Chair, is that the attendees in those areas have always dealt directly with the Society of the Cape of Good Hope, and that we believe is working smoothly. And you know, since the transformation of the legal profession was on the brink of coming into being, so that's where they are regulated from. That is the Swisskei and the old Swisskei and Transkei.
What's the matter? Pardon? Yes, I think we'll do the country a great service if we pass it today. Honorable Ankatan?
No, Chair, I was on the same point, that since you said that it depends entirely on us, then what is the way forward from here, given the challenges that you are having with different law societies in different even provinces that no longer exist in South Africa or understands.
We are going to make advance, have public hearings, get submissions,
get the department to respond to the submissions and then conclude the business and pass the act as soon as possible. What have the request? I support as soon as possible.
Let's keep that happening. Thank you.
Thank you.